Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. NEA jazz master Herbie Hancock will be performing at NJ Pack at the end of the month. WBGO's Pat Prescott spoke to the legendary pianist.
Usually I get a chance to talk to the audience and tell them they feel like they're part of my family.
Two of the founding members of the B-52s are honored in Red Bank. Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson are now on the Count Basie Center for the Arts Walk of Fame.
I love female jazz vocalists and have a huge collection, which people don't realize. They think I just watch crazy space movies all the time. But no.
And WBGO's John Kalish introduces us to an extraordinary optician in Brooklyn.
The business was started by Mordechai Menzler 45 years ago in the basement of his father's home here in Borough Park.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. Chicago-born jazz icon Herbie Hancock will be in concert at NJ Pack in Newark on July 31st. WBGO's Pat Prescott got a chance to explore more of the legendary artist.
You know, Herbie Hancock is beyond accomplished. He is an icon, a 14-time Grammy Award winner who spent six decades in music, and there's no sign that Herbie is stopping anytime soon. It is an honor to have a conversation with him today. Hey, Herbie, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much, Pat.
Out of those 14 Grammys, which one meant the most to you? Or was there one that stood out from the others at all?
I don't think about them. I mean, there are certain ones that stick out.
Mm-hmm. What about the first one? Do you remember that particularly?
The first Grammy? Let's see, which one was the first one? Was that the Headhunters Band? I don't even remember which one was the first. No.
What was the first one?
I don't remember.
So there you go.
I have to go down the road.
But it's nice to be recognized.
I have to go downstairs. I have a place where I have all the Grammys.
Uh-huh.
They were very, very lightweight, by the way.
And, really?
I didn't know they were lightweight until I got an Oscar. The difference in the weight between an Oscar and a Grammy was like huge. Then they made the Grammys heavier. Then after that, they started making Grammys heavier.
They had to catch up with the Oscars, huh?
Yeah, right.
I guess one honor, though, that has got to have really stood out for you was the Kennedy Center Honors. And I watched that. Boy, that was tremendous. And a high honor. It really is.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being there, you know, with the other honorees. And the president, and it was Barack Obama. It was just great.
Yeah, it was a wonderful night. Well, I know, Herbie, that we have talked before in the past, but none of those conversations were really long enough for me, as far as I'm concerned, to ask just a few questions I really wanted to ask. So let's get into it. I know that you were born and raised in Chicago, which, of course, is home to some of the biggest names in jazz. Benny Goodman, Eddie Harris, Coleman Hawkins, Quincy Jones, Ramsey Lewis, Tony Williams, your buddy. The list goes on and on. How important was your life experience in Chicago to your career?
That's my hometown, Chicago, you know? So it's where I started playing piano. It's where I first learned how to improvise. So it's my foundation.
And to add to that, legacy has been tremendous because you represent Chicago beautifully. And I think that's a great thing.
Oh, well, thank you.
It means everything. I understand that you were a piano prodigy, but also that in college you were really interested in science and electronics. That's true?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've always been I guess the word is curious. Ever since I was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, I was always trying to figure out, like, for example, how does the second hand work on a clock? I would get a screwdriver and try to take it apart to see how it worked. But I've always been like that. So, you know, tech stuff has always been interesting to me. Synthesizers and vocoders and various other things having to do with technology.
And I think that has really helped you to keep in step with things and not just keep in step, but really to set some trends in music as well. Now, I know that you were really young when you started recording and touring with people like Donald Byrd and, and Phil Woods and Oliver Nelson. What are some of the most impactful things that you learned from some of these legends?
Well, let's start with Donald Byrd. When I first played a gig with him, it was up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I remembered asking Donald, I said, you know, I'm okay for playing ballads. I'm okay for playing moderate tempos, but, you know, I have a trouble playing really fast tunes. You know, do you have any suggestions of how I can learn to actually play faster tunes? And he gave me a suggestion that came from another piano player. He said, take a form like 12-bar blues form. He said, write out some solo notes that you might play and practice that, not to just get it perfect, but just to get the fingers moving. Write out 5 minutes of that.
I want to talk real quick about two really important figures in your life and in jazz in general. You know, WBGO is located on what used to be Park Place and is now Wayne Shorter Way. Wayne Shorter meaning so much to that Jersey community and to the New York metropolitan area. And of course, his significance in jazz. But he was more than just a collaborator with you. He was like a brother. Talk a little bit about Wayne and the importance of him. We were so glad he got a chance to see Wayne Shorter Way become Wayne Shorter Way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Wayne really was, you know, my best friend, you know, and he, you know, still is, you know, and he's still kind of alive in my heart, you know, and he's still a huge influence on me and many of the musicians that I know. And we talk about him all the time, and in our shows we usually play something that Wayne wrote. But I learned a lot from listening to what Wayne would say. And we used to talk about what we call Wayne-isms. If you ask Wayne, you know, what does jazz mean to you? I remember him saying one time, jazz means I dare you. Which was great, and I understood what he was talking about,
and it was reflected in his work.
Absolutely. Reflected in his, and his compositions were so amazing. And then, you know, right near the end of his life, to do this beautiful ballet, and actually there's a piece that he wrote. It's an arrangement that he wrote for full orchestra of a song that I wrote during our time with Miles Davis, a song called Little One. And he made this big symphonic orchestra arrangement of Little One. And so many notes are on the page that I asked Wayne, I tried just to figure out what some of the parts were. And I said, but you didn't write any piano part for me. Because actually it's the orchestra accompanying me playing it. And he said, oh, you're free to play whatever you want to play. I said, what? Really?
In the midst of all those notes.
He said, that's why I've got all the... Yeah, right. That's why you got all of those notes in there, because it leaves me free to play whatever I want.
I love that. And that's so very Wayne Shorter, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's Wayne.
Well, you know, yeah, as
amazing.
Yeah. As we celebrate the Miles Centennial, I'm sure that a lot of people are asking you to talk about Miles. And I'd imagine you've been thinking about him a lot lately because of that. Can you share a special memory of Miles with us?
Well, he used to talk to us in the band about his time with playing with Charlie Parker, you know, and his friendship with Dizzy Gillespie in those days, and how Byrd was, you know, Charlie Parker, right? And how much he liked chicken. That's where the word Byrd, I think, came from, because he liked the bird, chicken, right? And some other funny stories that I can't talk about on radio or TV.
Well, one last thing I wanted to ask you about, and that was, I remember when you came out with the Headhunters project and hearing Chameleon for the first time. Actually, starting, I guess, with Wandishi and then Crossings and then Sextant. I mean, you were really starting to explore some other sounds, get into some of the electronics and all that thing. And during that whole period, there were some who criticized you, just like they did with Miles, for exploring the many facets of jazz. Now, when you look back on that time, how did it make you feel at that time? And how did you deal with that criticism and overcoming it throughout your career?
Well, criticism happens, and I just didn't let it push me back, because whatever I created, I put a lot of time and energy into it. And it was part of expressing myself and what I believe about exploring new territory, which I'm always into. And I encourage other people to be into that. So I don't let it stop me.
Well, I will say this: if success is revenge, you won, since Headhunters was the first jazz album to go platinum. And during the 70s, you had 11 albums on the pop charts, and you play in stadiums now, but you still give great respect and love to straight ahead jazz. I guess that everyone really settled down when they realized that you were going to still play straight ahead as well, and you continue to lead in expanding the boundaries of jazz. But with all the amazing music that you've created over the years, I do think that it's got to be exceedingly difficult to figure out which songs to play on a gig and how to play them, really. I catch you every year at the Hollywood Bowl, and every year is always interesting to see what you're going to play and how you're going to play it. And you come up with some really great creative versions of some of the songs that we all love. So what can we expect to hear from you when you return to the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in July?
Well, I hope that they will experience something new in our playing. I hope they experience a kind of camaraderie between the musicians and the audience. And usually I get a chance to talk to the audience and tell them they feel like they're part of my family.
Yeah.
Because they really are. We're the same species. We're human beings, right?
Amen. I'm definitely one of your cousins. I've been out there a long time feeling very close to you, as will a whole bunch of people who show up on Friday, July 31st at NJ PAC. The show's at 8:00. It's a one night only situation, so make sure to get your tickets, and you can visit njpac.org for more tickets, for ticket information, and to find out more about the show. And I got to say, Herbie, thank you so much for making my day. You have just thrilled us with your music for so many years. I too am thrilled with just the man that you are, just the human being that you are, and the things that are important to you.
Thank you very much, Pat. Thank you for this interview. Yeah. Hope to see you sometime.
Definitely. God bless you.
Great. Thank you.
I got me a car, it's as big as a wagon.
For more than five decades, the B-52s have been one of popular music's most distinctive and influential bands in the world. Their unmistakable blend of new wave, rock, and pop produced enduring hits including Rock Lobster, Love Shack, and Rome, helping the band sell more than 20 million records worldwide while earning multiple Grammy nominations. While the band is known for getting together in Athens, Georgia, founding members Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson share deep New Jersey roots. On Friday, the Count Basie Center for the Arts honored Schneider and Pearson by welcoming them onto its Walk of Fame. Adam Phillipson, president and CEO of the Count Basie Center for the Arts, says he's thrilled to honor Kate and Fred outside the historic theater in Red Bank.
We launched this Walk of Fame as part of our centennial celebration to honor artists who have performed on our stages, made an indelible impact on culture, and whose contributions reflect the enduring power of the arts. And today, we are proud to celebrate the addition of two more. With the first, we honor two founding members of one of the most original and beloved bands in music history. Thank you. These two New Jersey natives have spent the last 50 years proving that being your authentic self is the most powerful way to change the world. Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson of the B-52s helped create a band with a sound, style, and spirit entirely its own. And today we celebrate their contributions and their legacy by officially inducting them onto our Walk of Fame.
Red Bank Mayor Billy Portman shared some of his personal love for the B-52s.
This is a great honor. I'm gonna guess when I was about 10 or 11 years old, my cousin Rachel gave me the copy of your first album. And I would argue that first side of that first album holds up with any album ever put out in the history of rock and roll. It is a masterpiece. I remember in like third grade, like when we were learning to write haikus, they would say, here's what a haiku is, and now you go write one. That's what like the first 2.5 minutes of Planet Claire was for me. You guys were like, here's these wonderful, absurd lyrics, and now here's a blank slate for you guys to write your own. And I did. I wrote obsessively. I wrote B-52's lyrics in my bedroom for hours. So thank you guys for being here. Your music brings people together. It educates. It uplifts. And really, it's very appropriate to be doing it here at the Count Basie Theater. The Count Basie is an amazing organization. It does the same thing. It educates people. It uplifts people. It gives people a place to gather together. Hundreds of thousands of people come every year just to be a part of this amazing institution.
One of the first announcers to play the band's music on radio in New Jersey is Rich Robinson, who says the B-52s have always been very special to him.
So it was back in Athens, Georgia, that a couple of folks from New Jersey, especially Shore Regional's very own Fred Schneider, go Blue Devils, and Rutherford's favorite, Kate Pearson, went down to Athens, Georgia, and a bunch of group of friends got together and bonded under their love of like James Brown and Motown and Annette Funicello movies and interesting dress and all that stuff, and created a sound that no one had ever heard before. And soon, when they came up to New York, they got the world of industry buzzing in the record industry, and they got themselves a major label, and their first album came out. And I've always had a personal connection with the B-52s, because back in 79, when that first album came out, I owned a DJ company, and we were the only DJs on the Jersey Shore that were playing alternative music, new wave dance music, all the time, like not playing any disco, just new wave music. And every time I'd play Rock Lobster, hundreds of people would flood the dance floor and then dance like crazy and then pretend to be lobsters crawling on the floor. And because of them, more people would show up at the club, so I made a really good living, thanks to you two, for playing Rock Lobster.
We were at a party. Severe load fell in the day. Someone reached in and grabbed it. What a Rock Lobster.
The guests of honor then came to the podium.
I'm back to my old stomping ground, because I was raised in Oceanport, and I would come to Red Bank all the time. I remember Monarch Thrift Shop, Jack's Music Store, just everything. And I've seen Red Bank change, but it's changing as for the better. And it's just a real honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Wow. Well, it seems like we're our band is half as old as this whole theater. And,
oh, it is. And,
whoever thought we would be, you know, when we started in our first show on Valentine's Day, 1977, that we would be here in New Jersey. We've always been thought of as a Georgia band, but it's New Jersey-Georgia connection that really made the spark happen. And Fred and I are proud to be from New Jersey. I represent the northern part. I was born in Jersey City, I lived in Weehawken and then Rutherford, New Jersey. So I've seen a lot of farms and beautiful parts of New Jersey. And it's old theaters like this and record stores and DJs and students that keep the love of music going, the genuine love of music, not necessarily the commercial side, but the part like Fred's huge record.
The big
collection.
Tomatoes.
Exactly. And all that. Anyway, thank you so much for coming out and for this honor. It's amazing.
Both Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson are jazz fans. I had a chance to speak with Kate and Fred immediately after the ceremony.
You mentioned the word jam, and being a jazz station in Newark, many people, you know, liken the vocal arrangements that you were here at the Count Basie. What influences of jazz artists has there been for you, Fred?
Oh, I love the way Dinah Washington talks, sings. I love Billie Holiday. I know Kate likes, you know, Betty Roche. I mean, I love female jazz vocalists and have a huge collection, which people don't realize. They think I just watch crazy space movies all the time. But no.
How about you, Kate?
Well, my father was a big band guitar player when he was, well, he played guitar always, but in his youth, he was in a band, and he had a huge 78 record collection that included so many of the jazz female, especially the female vocalists. And so I was very influenced by jazz music. That's what I listened to growing up.
The B-52s and fellow Walk of Fame honorees, the New Jersey-based Dramarama, will be performing on Saturday at Park Stage in Freehold. You can hear my entire conversation with Fred Schneider and Kate Pearson of the B-52s at WBGO.org. In the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, there's an optician known for extremely affordable prices. The business boasts of its quick turnaround time and draws customers from beyond the neighborhood. WBGO's John Kalish dropped by to check out the store.
Minzer's Optical is located in a two-story building on a block of attached homes in Borough Park. The massive Maimonides Medical Center is just down the block. The business was started by Mordechai Minzer 45 years ago in the basement of his father's home here in Borough Park. The walls are lined with shelves displaying eyeglass frames, and in a small storage room, there are boxes of lenses for every eyeglass prescription imaginable.
We have a big round lens that already has a prescription in it, and then the scanner scans the frame. Then the lens goes into the edger, which is the grinder. It grinds it to the exact shape. Puts the needed bevel on it, and hopefully comes out the exact size.
Minzer's is a rarity in the world of retail opticians. It still has a full lab on the premises, so many of the eyeglasses it makes don't have to be sent out. The store has four edging systems that cut and grind prescription lenses to fit into the frames. Each system costs around $80,000.
Optician stores who do edging are becoming a lost breed. Lens crafters got rid of all their lab equipment. They don't make glasses anymore. Everyone's sending out now because it's just not worth it to have a lab at the premises. You need to pay a technician. Besides buying the machines and keeping them up, years ago, you couldn't get a decent pair of glasses made in a large lab. But now, everything comes back perfect from the lab. So why should they bother making it themselves? Let the customers wait a few days.
Since it began, Speedy Service has been an integral part of Minzer's business. He was 19 when he first started with retail clients. Friends and classmates also flocked to the basement.
I hated that they should pick her up a different day because it'll just pile up. I like to do it on the spot. They order it, come back in a half hour, it'll be done.
By the way, the business cards on the counter at Minzer's now boast of 15-minute service. The other thing that is unusual about this place is that there are tin charity boxes on the counter and Jewish prayer books lining a shelf for customers to use. Mordechai Minzer is an Orthodox Jew. He began his career at a Cohen's Fashion Optical store in Bay Ridge. Being a Sabbath observer created a problem there.
I worked very hard there. I didn't work on Shabbos. They had to have a different guy come in for Friday night and Shabbos.
After he took a day off for a Jewish holiday, Minzer says he was replaced.
I come back the next day to work, and there was a technician working in my spot. So I took my tools and I left. I looked for a job here and there, but it was very difficult because I was young and I refused to work on Shabbos. I had a few dollars I saved up from when I worked. I bought machines and I started to do wholesale work. I did favors on the side for friends. I made eyeglasses and they were very inexpensive. They were very well made. They told other people, and before I knew it, it exploded on me. It became very big.
Minzer says he charged a fraction of the price of his competitors. A Manhattan customer who used to spend between $700 and $800 for a complex progressives prescription recently paid less than $300 to have her lenses made at Minzer's. Some of the customers on a recent weekday afternoon were not Borough Park locals.
I live on Church Avenue.
Not that close.
No.
How long have you been a customer?
A few years.
How did you find out about it?
My mom. She would come to the hospital and she noticed this place and told me to come here and tell me I need glasses for my kids.
Are you a longtime customer?
Maybe 30 years that I recall. Could be more. The store is the best, and they're very friendly, very good prices, the best in the market.
How far do you come?
I come from Sunset Park, from 42nd, between 4th and 5th.
Yeah, it's not that close.
No, but it's worth it.
Mordechai Minzer says that over the years, his customer base has evolved from almost entirely Orthodox Jews to the point where today they're only about 30% of his clientele. His profitability has taken a hit, he says, thanks to online opticians such as Zenni. I met Yaakov Singer, a customer who had glasses made by Zenni and then came to Minzer's.
I wasn't happy because I'm taking progressives, and so I have to come back here. If you need progressive, you got to have the line done right, and you got to put it in the center of the eye, and I found that they didn't do it the right way.
When did you first start coming here?
Must have been 95 or 93.
If you know what you're ordering, it does come accurate.
Mordechai Minzer.
But 70% of the laymen who order that, they order it wrong. It's not ordered correctly. Those places, you got no service. You can't really try in the frames, regardless of all the technology.
Minzer's Optical has a minimal presence on the web, but the store has a tried and true way of attracting new customers.
Word of mouth.
Minzer's Optical is open 5 days a week. It's closed on Friday and Saturday for the Jewish Sabbath. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.